would like to encourage daily reading, regular study, not just once, not just going through the volumes once and saying, I did it. Or not just reading the volumes for class and saying, I'll get to it someday, because the class will get to it someday, but regularly and continuously as being valuable. Now, this is especially important for the elders, and in fact, I heard a talk just recently where a brother said if someone isn't studying the volumes regularly on his own, he should not be an elder. And of course, that principle is true not only for elders, but for everybody, because eldership, the qualifications are for elder are often seen as the basis of a true, mature Christian character. Now, our thoughts today, we're hoping would be to help get an appreciation for the fourth volume, and so we've got a few handouts. Just a quick explanation. The handout in the paper clips is mostly volume outlines, which we really won't be going over today, but we thought they would be useful. The first page being a one-sentence description of each volume, and then each page following being a brief outline description of the sort of layout of each volume in turn. They were done by Brother David Duran and Brother George Duhame, and then for a camp study, we finished the rest of them for them. The last page of the handout is a volume schedule. If you haven't read through the volumes regularly lately, New Year's is coming. It's a good chance to maybe give it a try. I know Sister Marcia sent them out several times this Christmas, and it was an encouragement for many to try them. And then the second to last page is a handout that we may actually look at during the talk itself, which we won't go into any detail on it, but it's an interesting. It's just interesting. We'll get to it. Now, obviously, in going through a whole 600-some page book in 1 hour, we're not going to be able to do much. We're going to overview the book, and we're going to pick out just a few highlights from each of the chapters. We're going to review some of the expectations that Brother Russell had, try to bring some things up to date, and note items that would be of special interest or question, or at least they were to me. Now, when this book was first published in 1897, it was very current, very relevant, and it was very exciting. The book is an end times subject book, and as such, end times has always been exciting to the church throughout the ages. And many times there have been messianic expectations, end time expectations that have been wrong. And the Lord never corrected those, because in 2 Peter 3:11, 2 Peter 3:11, we're told, what manner of persons ought we to be, especially as we see these days approaching. So therefore, the urgency that end time considerations can bring upon us is beneficial. Therefore, if we see anything in Brother Russell's writings that seems to miss the point prophetically, and we're going to emphasize it only seems to, then obviously it must have been for the church's benefit. For example, 1914, the church wasn't completed when Brother Russell expected. But that was a wonderful encouragement to the brethren leading up to that time. Now, the fourth volume as a book, then, is to us exciting, but unfortunately, it has fallen a little bit out of favor among some brethren. They call it out of date and boring, but we don't think it is. Brother Russell could have changed some of those quotes. The quotes were from the 1800s, and by 1914, 1916, they were, quote, out of date even then. But he did not. The book stands as a testimonial to its own correctness, even with those quotes. It's part of the harvest message. And those messages are the same then as they are today. We're looking at the forces in the world and the nominal systems that were leading to Armageddon. Those forces are still in force, and we have to be aware of them, even if some of them have been modified or changed a little bit. The book was originally entitled The Day of Vengeance. That's the old title, and if you have a Dawn book volume, the alternate pages in the volume have the title of the book, and it doesn't match the Battle of Armageddon. Now, the New Brunswick volumes changed that. But we'll explain this just a little bit. In 1912, former President Roosevelt was campaigning for another bid for office, and during one of his speeches, he used this expression, We stand at Armageddon and we battle for the Lord. Now you can find this an account of this in reprint 5062, reprint 5062. This was an instantly popularized expression, and Brother Russell then gave a famous discourse on Armageddon in November of 1912, and this you'll find in reprint 5137 reported. That's reprint 5137. At that time, he mentioned that he would change the name of the volume to The Battle of Armageddon. That sermon, or at least parts of it, became also the 1912 foreword. So let's proceed to the 1912 foreword. We'll go chapter by chapter from here on. Now, the 1912 foreword is not the first foreword in the book. It's actually called, I think it's just called foreword. I can't look into it. And so just a few points out of that foreword is, as an encouragement, though the age is to end in conflagration, the fact that we know that it is near means we're also close to our glorification. And that should be an encouragement to the church. Much of that chapter, or that foreword, is dealing with Revelation 16, verses 13 to 16, as Revelation 16, verses 13 to 16. This is the sixth plague of Revelation, of the seventh plague. Now, the sixth plague gathers the forces to Armageddon, which is what the entire book, the fourth volume, is about. The seventh plague basically is Armageddon. And during this sixth plague, you have three frog-like spirits. They issue from three powers. One is the dragon, which represents the civil powers, the civil governments. The beast, which represents the papal system, Catholicism. And you have the false prophet. It's elsewhere titled The Image of the Beast, and it represents the Protestant systems. All three of these systems have a common message that's represented in the messages from these three frogs. One, don't question our authority. They're the ones in charge. Don't question us. Secondly, we must maintain the status quo, because if you change it, there's going to be disaster. And the third message had to do with there is a divine right of kings. That's related to the first. To bring it up to date, we might call that at times executive privileges, where the bosses think that they're above the law, or even our presidents. Now, what this does is it gathers together these groups into a union, that they come together for power. Their triumph, though, will be brief. God enters, the Lord's great army destroys them, and such is the end. Now, a few quotes that we want to give from this. On page 16, in the New Brunswick's volumes, is page 14. Page 16 of the New Dawn, page 14 of the New Brunswick. Brother Russell says, God's side will be the people's side. We'll repeat that. God's side is the people's side against the rulers. And so if we want to be on God's side, we do not want to be in sympathy with this current order. Even though that order provides us our jobs, it provides us our secure homes, it provides us the banks and our secure living arrangements. God's side is with the rabble-rousers. Now, this doesn't mean that we're to be rabble-rousers ourselves. The saints are not to be participators in the battle, but they're to wait for the Lord on the sides of the battle. At this time, there were two features that yet had to be fulfilled before the end could fully come. One was that the image of the beast had to receive life or power from the two horned beast. And we would interpret that as being the Protestant systems receiving apostolic succession, probably through the two horned beast of Ireland and England, the Church of Ireland and England. And so Bible students are interested in the ecumenical movement. And we have seen approaches, and especially we had seen in late of the Episcopal Church getting close to the Protestant Church. The Episcopal Church being the American branch of the Anglican, English Church. But recently we heard of a consolidation between the Lutherans and the Catholics, a cross-ordination. And this strikes right to the heart of the Reformation and undoing it. The second thing that Brother Russell was expecting in his day that had to occur was the Jews had to return to Palestine. Something we've seen happen, so there's very little between us now and the final conflagrations. We're spending too much time already, and so let's go on to the next foreword. It's what we call the 1916 foreword. It's the second one in the book. No, it's the first. It's the first one in the book. It's also called the author's foreword. At this time, the Great War, World War I, was now in progress, and so some of the comments had to do with the things that they were expecting based on seeing that war. Brother Russell expected that the war would end in financial weakness, and as a result of that, and also a perplexity of what to do with these millions of men, immense numbers, returning. And you know, the social and economic situation was doing fine without all these people. What are we going to do with them? It was a problem. And so Brother Russell expected that the financially weakened and troubled nations would look to the churches and cooperate with them. A future church-state union from Brother Russell's time. But this reign as a queen would be short, and then Babylon would fall, and when they fell, the financial and social rulers would sort of step back and say, well, I'm not part of that, because they know that the fall of Babylon portends their own fall. A couple notable quotes. Page 4. Man's extremity will be the Lord's opportunity. The extremity of man and the greatest trouble will be the opportunity that the Lord will have of pouring out blessing. This expression is also found elsewhere in the volume and in other places in the volumes too. I think Brother Russell liked that expression. Page 5. He, the Lord, will permit the wreck of society and then reorganize humanity under Messiah. And this is the whole purpose of the day, of the Battle of the Great Day, the Battle of Armageddon. Now, there's a quick note on the war. Brother Russell was correct in expecting that it would end through financial collapse. But in that war, only one side collapsed. There was no clear military victory in World War I. And Brother Russell expected that there would be revolution to follow. And though there was a little bit in Germany and the Soviet Union, or Russia creating the Soviet Union, nevertheless, it wasn't to the extent Brother Russell expected at the time. Now, Brother Norby was very big on saying that the socialism that swept the world may have been a fulfillment of that. What we wanted to say, though, was that Brother Russell's expectation wasn't exactly right, so either we must modify Brother Russell's expectations a little bit or look for the same thing and set aside his date expectations. We have to use intelligence. The point is that it wasn't yet time for the end in Brother Russell's day, even though he expected it, but it also wasn't the time to know it. Let's go on to the first chapter, the Day of Vengeance. It's an introductory chapter, and we'd like to give just a quick quote on it, page 13. It is not our purpose to arouse a mere sensation or to seek to gratify idle curiosity. This book was not a National Enquirer book to be exciting from that stand. It wasn't merely to tell somebody what's happening because they're merely curious. Its intent was to build up the saints in this last day, and thus its inclusion as one of a series. Much of the chapter deals with one of the pictures of the end times found in Isaiah chapter 63, verses 1 through 6. That's Isaiah 63, 1 through 6, where we have, who is this that cometh from Edom, from Bozrah, with dyed garments? And we have the expression of the treading of the winepress, a real violent picture, where Edom pictures Christendom, or the Babylon of Revelation. The same picture is found in Revelation 19, verse 18. Revelation 19, verse 18, where we have the vine of the earth, which is a false vine, nominal systems, is cast into this winepress. The destruction is being a final work. The point is that the day of vengeance is there to destroy Babylon and earth society. But the dashing will prove a valuable lesson to mankind, having seen this, when they come forth and compare in the millennium. And on page 20, we have a little quote again. Thus, in his wrath, the Lord will remember mercy. Chapter 2, the doom of Babylon, or Christendom. And then he has mini Tekeliaparsin, which brings, of course, to mind Babylon, the Belshazzar's feast, and the destruction in Daniel chapter 5. And it's a good scriptural chapter on the character of Babylon. Brother Russell points out that the fall of literal Babylon, this mini Tekeliaparsin, pictures the fall of symbolic Babylon, the nominal systems. They are weighed in the balances, both mother and daughter systems, and they're found lacking because of their character and their acts. What are we supposed to do? We're supposed to flee from out of her. We're supposed to have nothing to do with the nominal systems. Once again, Revelation 18, verse 4. Revelation 18, verse 4, come out of her. And it's also found in Jeremiah 51, verse 45. That's Jeremiah 51, 45. Brother Russell gives a little bit of advice at this time. We cannot escape or avoid this trouble. It's coming. Nothing we can do will. We cannot hide in trust or trust in finances. All the money in the world won't save us. Or in societal positions. Or in the police. Or even in a literal cave. We cannot hide from it. All will go down. And so we must make the Most High our refuge. That's in Psalm 91, verse 9. Chapter 3. The necessity and justice of the day of vengeance. Why is it necessary? Why can't we just glide smoothly into the kingdom and let the Lord train everybody properly? Well, just as in the Jewish harvest, the Jews, God's people, because of their repeated failures, were punished. The Lord used Rome to punish them. It says in Matthew 23:35, that all the blood from Abel to Zacharias was going to be required of that generation. And that seems very, very strong and strict. Until we realize that they were held more accountable because they should have known better, and they should have been able to reason from history about their wrong course, and especially the Bible, which they had. So in the end of the age, as the result of the repeated evils of the systems, of the governments, and of common people, they will be punished. Because we have more knowledge now than at any time in history. Look at our libraries, or the availability of information on the web. There is no excuse not to know what the lessons of history are. So therefore, having disregarded the repeated warnings of history, only a calamity will end it. We're going to quickly note some of the groups that are going to be affected at this time. First of all, the kings. The kings, by their oppression, by being evil, they bred the very hatred which rose up to destroy them. This is the testimony of history. Today's rulers, political and financial, should recognize the same thing. How many unreasonable bosses are there, those who, because of their position, take advantage of it and breed a discontent among their workers? Another group, the ecclesiastics. They should know better, and therefore are therefore held more responsible. But nevertheless, they corrupt themselves with a worldly spirit. How about the heathen? Well, you know, the heathen can't be held responsible. They don't have the Bible. But Romans 1 tells us that even the heathen have a knowledge of good and evil. And there is a lot of contact with the Western world. There's no excuse for them to know right and wrong in the lessons of history. So they too will be destroyed. Now up to this point, in these three chapters, the volume has dealt mostly with scriptures and more general principles. But following this chapter and up to chapter 10 are the chapters that are often seen as the tedious part. Full of quotes, not very many scriptures. And we would not want to advise anybody to skip them. Maybe go over them a little faster, possibly. But nevertheless, we do expect to find certain principles that will be valuable for us in each of these chapters. So let's go to chapter 4. Babylon arraigned before the great court. Do you know what an arraignment is? What is an arraignment? Well, I didn't know before I studied volume 4. What an arraignment is just simply a reading of the crimes, a presenting of the sins. This is before the trial. We're saying, this is what you're being brought in. So we'll give a preliminary listings of the sins of Babylon. First of all, the rulers take unfair advantage of their position in order to oppress the people and to indulge themselves. Secondly, the rulers are heralding their status, how wonderful and important we are. The ecclesiastics brag of their accomplishments and also their position. Our bosses often do the same thing. The leaders extravagantly squandered the resources with not only personal wealth, but with huge standing armies and governmental projects. The nations had run up unconscionable debts. There was not enough gold to pay the interest at that time. And that burdened the populace. That was the third thing. The fourth is a very nice little statement. The rich wallow while the poor languish. We're going to see this also in chapter 7, the preparation of the elements in chapter 8, the cries of the reapers. The fifth charge is that the churches should have known better, but they are no better. They've amassed fortunes, and they've also used the doctrine of hell to try to intimidate and to control people. Even today, the evangelicals are more rabid about the subject of hellfire than they were in Brother Russell's day. And the JWs, supposedly descendants of the truth movement, and should have known better, use the second death to try to intimidate. Chapter 5, Babylon before the great court. Her confusion, nationally. This is talking about the nations and their interactions. And at that time, vast resources were being used and manpower being poured into preparedness of standing armies and wars. And there was a general recognition among all the nations and the leaders that there was an impending doom coming. This is just before World War I. We'll give some quotes. Page 116. Peace is supposed to be guaranteed by the fear of war. That's why they were building up their arms. If each army was strong, then nobody would start a fight. In modern times, we call that détente. Does that work to stop wars? It certainly didn't. Page 122. The very effectiveness of modern weapons makes war improbable. We'll read that again. Remember, this is the turn of the century. The very effectiveness of modern weapons makes war improbable. And then follows a description of some of the weaponry. And we sometimes smile. The mitrailleuse, which was a kind of French machine gun, or the Gatling gun, or a cannon that could hurl a shell 8 miles. These were fantastic things. We smile because today's machine guns and weaponry makes these things pale by comparison. And cannon can now shoot shells 23 miles. Did any of this stop war? Hardly. The problem is this, that when a country builds up for their defense, a strong defense for protection is seen by their neighbors as a threat. So the neighbor has to build up their armament. What do you get? An arms race. And there's a dilemma here. Suppose you don't participate in that arms race. When hostilities break out, you're the first one to fall. And this is exactly what has happened, especially in World War II, when all the peaceful countries were swallowed up by the Germans. So it's a dilemma. You either have to waste your money on the war, or you're going to suffer. Brother Paul Malley made an interesting point. All arms races end in war or financial collapse. At the turn of the century, that arms race ended up in a war, World War. The Cold War ended in the financial collapse of the Soviet Union. Now, Joel 3, verses 9 through 11 describe this time. Joel 3, 9 through 11. We're to prepare war and beat the plowshares into swords, the opposite of our peace group. And it's almost a perfect description, not only of the current time, the preparedness of war, but at that time especially, because so many of the boys that used to be behind plows, because, what was it, half or two-thirds of the population was agricultural? Those boys were now behind rifles. Now, the United States, Brother Russell noted, was relatively favored at the time and wasn't involved. But he said they would not escape the doom. And this was almost prophetic because the United States did enter the war in 1917 after Brother Russell's death and has been a significant power since then. One thing we'd like to sort of close this chapter with mentioning starts with a subhead on page 150. The cry of peace, peace, when there is no peace. And that's based on a scripture in Jeremiah 6, verse 14. What it was about was this wonderful peace assembly that was being held on the occasion of the completion of the Baltic Canal, which was a canal dug across the Baltic Peninsula, a section of northern Germany that connected the Baltic Sea with the North Sea, which is a part of the Atlantic Ocean, which meant that shipping from inland could now go directly to the Atlantic instead of having to go all the way around the Baltic Peninsula. So they were going to make a big peace assembly from this. How wonderful for peace it was. So what did the delegates send to this peace assembly? To commemorate this wonder of peace, they sent their dreadnoughts, which are battleships. and their guns to show how powerful they were, and they swam around in the ocean grimacing at each other and firing off peace gun salutes, all in the name of peace. The hypocrisy was so immense at the time that the papers were just full of it. And of course it didn't work. Chapter 6, Babylon before the great court, her confusion, Ecclesiastes. This chapter is mostly about the ecumenical movement. Brother Russell was very much against the ecumenical spirit, the coming together of these different groups, because it was not based on truth. And so that's why we see today, when we get upset with the ecumenical spirit, when we see it among our brethren today. But basically the problem with the Babylonian system was that they had taught the precepts of men and ignored the truth. They had gone worldly. And you can't just blame the ecclesiastics and the rulers, because the members were willing tools. They weren't ignorant. They were willingly supporting their leaders. The systems were inconsistent, and they lacked piety and godliness. I mean, how many of us have seen somebody at work or that claims to be a Christian, but then they swear? Or they do other things in their personal lives that just don't seem to fit with true Christianity. And also, the systems failed to convert the world. They claimed they were going to convert the world to Christianity. Now, in the face of this, how do weakened Christian systems get more power? Well, they compromise, doctrinal compromise, and they seek a union for self-advancement. And in Brother Russell's day, he pointed out that the Protestants were becoming more and more Roman. And he used the example of the Methodist Church. The Methodists were the original holy rollers. Their meetings were very wild. Preachers didn't have churches, but they were circuit preachers, and they'd wander around. And they couldn't stay in one place too long, so that it generated a lot of excitement. But by Brother Russell's time, the churches had sort of settled down and evolved into a more stable church with regular buildings in it. It's interesting, some of the brethren from Wilmington came out of the Methodist Church, and they visited back once or twice, and they said that it had gotten so ceremonial and Catholic in their services that they just couldn't even recognize it. Then there's a long section, 62 pages, on a strange event called the World Parliament of Religions. Nobody knows about the World Parliament of Religions in history. What this was during the Columbian Exposition in Chicago in the year 1893, the Presbyterians invited a large group of religions from all over the world to get together and present certain papers and positions. And the idea was to erect a framework of universal religious affiliation. It was the ecumenical movement on a grand scale, but it flopped. Good thing. Nevertheless, there's a couple things that this parliament started the ball rolling. Very significant historically. First of all, it introduced heathenism into the United States in its best possible light. And many of our heathen religions, I believe the Hindu, Buddhist, look to this parliament as their introduction to the United States. We find, following this, a dramatic rise in Spiritism. Well, Spiritism, witchcraft, these are seen as legitimate alternative religions. We must be acceptable. And even modern times, we have a friendly Casper, a Samantha, or should we say Sabrina, and even a Harry Potter that sort of like presents Spiritism in a very benign manner, sort of getting us so that it's not that bad after all, is it? A second thing that it fostered was a mother-daughter cooperation. Because suddenly you have the heathen to contend with. And in order you have to combine forces in order to overcome a common enemy. A third thing that this parliament did was to reveal the weakness of modern Christianity. The Christians at this parliament squabbled, they babbled, and they capitulated. The heathen looked very good. And fourthly, it illustrated the fact that union was a matter of policy only, and not a matter of truth. What makes this section especially interesting is, maybe you remember some brethren did mention a few things. In 1993, some people tried to do it again. It's 100 years. Let's have another World Parliament of Religions. Now, whereas at the first parliament there were 400 participants, 1893. In the 1993 Parliament, there were 400 groups and 6,000 participants. Unfortunately, the non-Western religions and all sorts of wackos were the ones that dominated. So therefore, it flopped. Well, any union would have been useless anyway. They tried to prepare a final statement that everybody could agree upon, and they couldn't even use the word God in that final statement and be acceptable to all. The rest of the chapter deals with more examples of the ecumenical movement and ends with a scripture, Nahum 1, verse 10. Nahum 1, verse 10, which describes what the ecumenical movement is. They shall be folded together as thorns. And it's a good illustration. You can get them together, but they're all still thorns, and they're sort of like pricking at each other. It's uncomfortable. Chapter 7. The nations assembled in the preparation of the elements for the fire of great fire of God's indignation. The whole point of Armageddon is that the nations have to be gathered to Armageddon. Now, how are they gathered? Are they gathered geographically? Well, in modern times, there's more than just geography. Brother Russell suggests travel brings people together, the telegraph, and of course, compared to the telegraph, what do we have today between the telephones and satellite communications? And books. And of course, today we have television and the internet, so the world can be brought together very quickly in common interests and activity. And of course, the intent of the gathering is for God to pour his fury upon them. Now, one of the main forces driving people to Armageddon is financial. Some are heaping treasures, while others are getting poor. The rich wallow, while the poor languish. And there's a gap between the rich and the poor that was especially starting during the Industrial Revolution in the late 19th century, but it's been getting greater and greater. And this gap is one of the primary causes of the discontent at the bottom. Brother Russell mentioned three things which were causing the poor to get poor. One was that of machinery displacing the workers, forcing them to compete for the lower jobs especially, and causing the wages to be depressed. A second bad influence on wages was women entering the workforce. Not only is this increased competition for the available jobs, and especially the low-paid ones, but today it creates another burden. And since we've seen, mothers are no longer raising their families, increasing the domestic troubles that we have in the world. And secondly, an employer no longer feels he needs to pay a living wage. He expects both the husband and wife to work, so it forces them to work at lower pay. Now, we see some financial relief today. Most of our children have not known any hardship. Many of us haven't either. But financial disasters are cyclical, and it is promised to come. Even all the pundits today recognize that somewhere along the line, this bubble of financial security we have will break. It's very well described by a subhead on page 372. Humanity is caught between the upper and nether millstones. Let's go to chapter 8, the cries of the reapers. This also deals with a financial problem, but a more specific one. And because brethren have some difficulty understanding what it's all about, I'm going to try to explain it. Sister Marcia says that it's impossible and I can't do it. Let's see what happens. The cries of the reaper is based on the scripture in James 5, verse 4. James 5, verse 4. Behold, the hire of the laborers, the hire, of course, being the wages of the laborers, who have reaped down your fields, his workers, which is of you kept back by fraud. Talking about some way of fraudulently holding back the wages of the workers. And in this chapter, it's mostly the produce of the farmer that's being dealt with. But it applies to most common laborers and as a general principle. Now, what is meant by being kept back by fraud? What happened here was a supposedly beneficial act was really a fraudulent way of stealing from the poor. Now, the example used is something called the demonetization of silver. Whatever that means. And the whole 18 pages is spent on it. It's also called, the demonetization of silver was also called free silver. Now we'll explain it. Back in the 1800s, gold and silver as metals were used as money also. An exact weight of gold was worth X dollars. An exact weight of silver was worth X dollars. And when you made coins, you took the exact weight, made them into a coin, and whether it was a gold bullion or a bunch of coins, it had the same buying power. It was money. Well, what happened Well, in general, though, silver favored the poor. Silver was more available. So poor countries and poor people had it easier access to get silver coinage. The rich had the gold. Well, the financiers fraudulently convinced the politicians that it would be good for this country to eliminate silver as a currency and use gold only. Maybe because it would be easier to control the gold reserves than all the silver reserves. The politicians went along with it. Free silver became act. And their silver changed in price as a commodity. What happened was the price of silver plummeted. Now what happens is if you have gold, if you're rich and have gold, you can go to another country and convert your gold into twice or three times as much silver and buy more wheat in India than you could buy in the United States using gold. The net effect was that the farmers were hammered horribly. And the financiers made out handsomely because they were the ones with the gold. They could buy the wheat at depressed prices because they were paying for it in silver after converting their gold, bring it back to this country, and they could jack up the price, and they were making money hands over fist. So what does a government do when they find out they've boo-booed and made a mistake? They waffle. And that's exactly what happened. They did not reverse the law. Now, of course, since then, the laws have been changed back and forth. But what happened was that the fraud crushes and discourages and causes an embitterment, especially among the lower classes, who are now made ripe for revolution. Some of the former upholders of the law, like the conservative farmers, now are ready to join the ranks of the discontent. And these things can occur in a short time. In general, whenever there is a financial change made of any kind, the poor suffer. The rich can take their resources and change them around wherever they can go, and they don't suffer. But the poor can't do that. And so whatever, they're stuck with whatever comes down the pipe. Chapter 9, The Conflict Irrepressible. The Testimony of the Worldly Wise. A lot of quotes here, we won't go over much. These are worldly people. They did not need the Holy Spirit to see that something was wrong. Just a couple points that the chapter brings out. First of all, education brings greater desires, greater demands, and greater discontent. So it doesn't really help much, does it? Also, labor and capital are totally irreconcilable. Why are they irreconcilable? Can't they get together and bargain? No, because both are claiming the same right to consult, to combine, and to control. And since they have different purposes, there's no way they can. Nevertheless, the rich are a minority. And when trouble breaks out, they will suffer, and rightly so, at the hands of the masses. Because the rich had the ability to help, but they didn't. And they will be held responsible. Now, the next chapter is one that's sort of one of my favorites. Chapter 10, Proposed Remedies. You have a problem, have a fix. Anything break around the house, I'm fixing things all over, making little modifications. Drives Marsha nuts at times. But in the world, there are all sorts of people offering solutions to the problems to try to fix it and make it better. And we'll go over some of them. It's an evidence of man trying to rule himself by various ways. And of course, the failure of each of them proves that man cannot do it. One that was suggested was called prohibition and female suffrage. Get rid of alcohol, literal drunkenness, people will be better. Give the woman a chance to vote. Then she's going to overrule all these warlike tendencies that the men have. So did giving women the vote really improve the war situation? Did it stop wars? Obviously not. And prohibition didn't stop anything either. A second suggestion was free silver, which we've already discussed, and protective tariffs. These are financial tinkerings. And it is impossible for them to work either, because we've already seen financial things help one class, usually at the expense of another. A third suggestion made for a solution was communism. We're talking about true communism, not Soviet or totalitarian style communism. And communism was actually tried in the early church. I think we're aware of it. In Acts 2, chapters 44 and 45, the early church set up a communistic type of society. But it's not mentioned again. We suspect that it failed. Chapter 6 in Acts sort of suggests that because there was a problem with the distribution of the money to the widows. And this is where we get the institution of the deacons. Paul himself worked with his own hands to support himself. And in 1 Timothy 5:6, he admonishes us to provide for our own. A fourth possible solution was anarchy. How is anarchy a solution? Where their thought is, destroy everything, wipe the slate clean, and whatever rises has to be better than what we have now, because what we have now is so bad. Well, this is a very cynical way of curing it, but it was an honest suggestion in those days, and the governments were afraid of it. A fifth possibility, socialism or collectivism. This is where you have public ownership and management of the land, corporations, and the government. Again, not Soviet style. Brother Russell mentions this most highly as all the possible solutions as being beneficial. And in fact, our country adopted socialist policies under Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Let me name some of them. Social Security is socialist. Public works, welfare, government regulations in order to curb industrial owners. Clean air, water, and the environment. That's socialist. OSHA. Big in the news lately. And of course our transportation systems, the laws of safety. Those are all socialist policies. Not Republican, not Democratic, not anything else. Now, the socialist revolution worldwide is often seen by some Bible students as a partial fulfillment of the earthquake in 1 Kings 19:11 and 12. That's where you have the wind, earthquake, and fire. Of course, the fire follows the earthquake, and the fire is anarchy. Another solution was general education. Get everybody educated and everybody will be happy. I think we've already mentioned how education brings greater desires, greater demands, and greater discontent. Another interesting one was called single tax. The point was that the problems in society are caused by a predatory ownership of land. Too many people own everything. I mean, too few people own everything. Get rid of that. Everybody now uses the land that they can, and then you only pay tax on what you use. Now, how you do that is beyond me, but Brother Russell spent a lot of time on it. And lastly, he suggested another suggestion, well, let the churches rule. The churches are benevolent institutions. Give them power and say, and things will be better. But history denies this. When the churches did rule, we called it what? The Dark Ages. It was one of the lowest points in human history. The only thing that will help is God's kingdom. It will fail. It will work when the others fail because, well, let's start with Psalms 2, verse 9. In Psalm 2, verse 9, we have present society being broken down, broken to pieces as a potter's vessel. In Zephaniah 3, 9, we have a promise that he will turn to the people a pure language. That's Zephaniah 3, verse 9. We also know that Satan's going to be bound, so that this force, which is a dictatorship, combined with mercy, with peace, and with training in righteousness, would work. Now, there's a little subhead titled, What is the Proper Attitude for God's People? We're admonished to practice moderation and honesty in all our dealings. And we're to be a good steward of everything we have, whether great or small. We are not to be wasteful. We're not to be like the world when they follow after fads and trends. And another one, if our job conflicts with Christian principles, and often they do, if say we're a bartender, then we change jobs. Now this ends the central, what some thought of as the tedious part of the book, and we'll go into the last four chapters, which are far more scriptural. Chapter 11 is entitled The Battle of Armageddon. And this is where Brother Russell deals with the battle in much greater detail scripturally. It's a very complex time, and many different symbols are used to express different aspects of this. And we're only going to mention some of them, and we're not even going to mention the scriptures because we're actually running behind time. We have one expression, which is found in quite a few scriptures. They call it the Battle of the Great Day of God Almighty, or several variations of it. Battle of Great Day, the Battle of God Almighty. Battle of the Lord. It's also called an earthquake. In Revelation 16:18 and Hebrews 12:26, and we mention those scriptures because this isn't quite the same earthquake as the one we mentioned in 1 Kings 19. This earthquake is talking about the final conflagration. Another picture of this Armageddon is fire. And I think we're familiar with that. Several scriptures deal in these last days as though a fire burning to destroy everything. And lastly, it's called a whirlwind and a storm. So each of these pictures deal with various aspects of this impending catastrophe. Further, also deals with two different types or figures or pictures in history of this catastrophe. One is the Jewish trouble, which we've discussed quite a bit in our second volume study, the trouble on the nation at the end of the Jewish age. And the second one, which Brother Russell deals with far more specifically in this chapter, is the French Revolution as a picture or illustration of how bad things will get. If you want to know what it's going to be like, read the horrors and atrocities that occurred during the French Revolution. We suspect that that's the way the world is going to get again. Now, the conditions that prevailed that led to the French Revolution are the following. And see if they prevail today. The few rich own the bulk of the wealth and at times abuse it. Secondly, the governments were corrupt and they were serving themselves and special interests. Another thing is that there was a loss of respect for authority. And don't we see this among our young people today? Then the governments responded, a fourth thing, with abortive reforms, political and social speculation. And we find this, there are more pieces of legislation going through our governments than ever before. And they fixed the tax code by making it simpler. What do? They've actually added hundreds and hundreds of lines of code and made the tax code more complex than it's ever been. That's how they fixed things. And of course, the French Revolution had a fresh example of the American Revolution. That's what they were trying to follow, although they blew it and fallen. Now, how are we going to be delivered from this catastrophe? Well, first of all, the faithful are promised that they will be delivered before the full force hits. And that is a blessing for those of us who are consecrated. But what about the unconsecrated? And this is where the children might want to pay a little bit of attention. What kind of promises are there in this time of trouble for those that haven't consecrated? And we'd like to read a scripture. In fact, there was a whole camp once just on this scripture. It's found in Zephaniah 2, verse 3. Zephaniah 2, verse 3. It's near the end of the Old Testament. Zephaniah 2, verse 3. This is the only promise, Brother Russell says, really a promise. Seek ye the Lord, all ye meek of the earth, which have brought his judgment. This is where it really starts. Seek righteousness. Seek meekness. It may be that you shall be hid in the day of the Lord's anger. So when the day of the Lord's anger comes, there is no promise for anybody who isn't practicing righteousness that they would be saved in any way. They will suffer the severest of the trouble. The only way we can protect ourselves is by doing that which we should be doing anyway. Not necessarily consecrated, but by behaving righteously. That means trying to find out the right thing to do. In this chapter, Brother Russell deals with the Lord's great army. What is it? It's found in Joel 2, verses 2 through 11. It's Joel 2, verses 2 through 11. Well, one thing the Lord's great army is, it's not the saints with the sword of the Spirit. They're not the ones doing the fighting. Besides, the saints are a little flock. They're not a great army or a great company. Brother Russell said that the Lord's great army is also not a national army, but rather it is a mob. And he described it just as such. Now, in his day, he expected that what was going to happen was all these millions of men were going to return from the war with training on how to kill. And because of the social revolution, they were going to turn all that training against their masters, and that would be the basis of the Lord's great army. Well, that didn't quite happen that way. And today we don't think that the veterans are going to be the prominent group because the armies have been so much smaller since then. Nevertheless, there are militia groups around, and TV and the movies have very adequately taught all our children very well how to shoot. That plus the NRA really pushing towards ready gun access will mean that when the time comes, there will be more than an adequate army of people capable of using armament and and willing to do that. Now, the Lord, interestingly, takes credit for the work done by the Lord's great army. Now, we're going to emphasize it's the work done by the Lord's great army. He does not take credit for their character. And though all of this trouble will fall first and most specifically upon Babylon, then all the nations, the final blast is going to be on Israel. And it's found in Ezekiel 38, and it's called Jacob's Trouble. But before Jacob's trouble could happen, in Brother Russell's day, he had to see a regathering of the Jews to Palestine. Have the Jews been regathered to Palestine? It shows that prophecy is marching on. We're getting closer and closer to that. Their prosperity will prompt their plundering by Gog and Magog. And this is one of the things that we are looking for as something possibly very imminent. With Russia and possibly the European Union joining together to go down and plunder Israel. But by God rising up and destroying Gog and Magog, he will be displayed to all the people, and then the world will be ready for the work of restitution. Chapter 12, our Lord's great prophecy. We're not going to go into this chapter. It is an excellent chapter to go into for yourselves, and we highly recommend it. It's a verse-by-verse dealing with Matthew 24. But we're just going to mention a couple points that we thought were very interesting out of the chapter. First of all is the sign of the Son of Man in heaven. What is that? That's found on pages 598 and 599. This sign is going to appear in heaven. What's the heaven? What's the ecclesiastical heavens? The religious world. So something would come to the religious world that would be a sign. But if it's a sign, that doesn't mean everybody's going to understand it, does it? Only those who have their eyes open, only the church is going to see this sign. And this is what we believe that sign is. Okay, we suggest we're seeing, if you see the divine plan, that's the recognition of the sign. And especially the times and seasons. The chronology is important for understanding it as being a sign. Do we see the judgment upon Babylon? Do we see the gathering of the elect and the harvest as events that are related? And last, though Brother Russell doesn't really bring it out this way, but we think that it's justified by an evaluation of verses 45 to 51 of that servant, a recognition of that servant means that we have seen the sign in heaven. And it's only the church that's going to see it. So we think that these are very important things in this end of the age, the divine plan and a recognition of the source of that divine. The second thing we wanted to mention was some of the symbols that are used. And this is where that last handout page, or second to last page of handout, will come in handy. There are several symbols that are used, and Brother Russell applies them both figuratively and symbolically. There's darkening of the sun. You want to read about that. Some falling stars, some magnificent falling star displays, one of which, by the way, is the Leonid showers in 1833. Was just historically phenomenal. It's mentioned on that sheet just briefly. This Wednesday night and Thursday morning is the same Leonid shower that occurred in 1833, and this year they think it might be fairly good again. So they've suggested if you want to get up early in the morning Thursday and look into the sky, you might see the Leonid shower. And if you do, think of this chapter in the fourth volume. Maybe look it over. Nevertheless, we have a chart there which shows how you might find some dates. And Brother Russell made two suggestions of dates in that chapter. And you'll see his suggestions sort of like bolded boxed on that page. One of them was to 1880, which would be a completed prophetic interpretation of the verse in Matthew 24 or 34, when you see these things occur, then know that the kingdom is not. The other was a possible interpretation of a future completion in 1914 that did not pan out. Now, the brethren, if you watch For This Cause, it's presented there, have another possibility, a future date that's based on a starting in 1948. Now, if you go to the 1880, this is a completed prophecy. We're not to look for another. But in any case, if you look at that chart, you can see the danger of date setting. It is too easy to come up with dates all over the place and be set aside. We're going to have to hurry through the last couple chapters here. The establishment of the kingdom and how it will manifest itself. The kingdom in one small way started at the first advent. But Matthew 11:12 tells us, that until now, this kingdom in its embryonic phase has suffered violence. But the first work of the kingdom is the gathering of elect in 1878. And the gathering is not yet complete, or we wouldn't be here, would we? Nevertheless, the kingdom doesn't wait for the gathering of the church, but it started at once. The kingdom is set up before it does any work. And the church engages in kingdom work before they are changed. And that should be an excitement to us. When we're working for the Lord, we can actually consider it as kingdom work this side of the veil, with the privilege that if we're faithful, when we go to the other side, we might have an even more direct application. Under the seventh trumpet picture in Revelation 11, 15, 17, and 18, that's Revelation 11, starting in verse 15, we have this order of events. The power is first taken and the reign begun. That's the first thing that happens. Following it comes the judgment on the world and the nations. So when we come to the discussion of is the Lord reigning or not, if the Lord came and the judgment has begun, then his reign must have begun before that. It's a very basic scriptural principle. Chapter 14, the last chapter. Jehovah's footstool made glorious. There's several scriptures which talk about the footstool of Jehovah. What in the world is that? We believe the footstool is the earth. And when we get to Zechariah 14, you might see that a little better. That footstool is not glorious now. It's promised that it will be made glorious. But at the close of the millennium, that footstool, the earth, will be glorious. Now in Zechariah 14, verses 4 and 5, we have the picture of Jehovah's feet upon the Mount of Olives. And this is very symbolic. Jehovah standing on the earth, as it were. This mountain is split into two parts, the northern and southern part, which represents the two parts of the kingdom. The earthly part, or Israelitish part, and secondly, the heavenly part. Well, when you split a mountain in half, you have a valley in between. And this is a valley of blessing into which the whole world can flee for protection. And this is what the millennium is for. Zechariah 14, 6 and 7 talk about a strange day which is partly light and partly dark. Well, we feel this represents the millennium very well because it's no longer dark like the gospel age was, or the 6 days of sin and degradation, but it's also not completely light yet. But at the end, it will be. And in verse 8, the living waters go out to bless the world. Now such is the ultimate purpose, we believe, for the battle of Armageddon. Ultimately, the blessing of the world in his time. And that's why we believe this book is so important to go over, to read, and to understand the principles in there. Even if some of the political and religious quotes might be hard to wade through. And we sort of hope that by touching on some of these points, that when you study the fourth volume yourself, or you read it yourself, you might remember some of these points, and it will help you the next time you go through, or say maybe it's even the first time you go through the first fourth volume. So with that, we'd like to close and ask the Lord would add his blessing in the middle of the will and set of this.
I have two comments, if I may. I know we study politics. I was in politics. I was going to make a statement now that you think of it when you define. The most powerful lobby in the history of the United States is the gun lobby. National Rifle Association. Based on low membership, based on low dues, so strong that they can cause people to lose their privileges. A couple did. Number two, when you're in management studies, you're almost required to read the book of Robert Barron's, the 12-minute control of the United States. In fact, it was so strong in 1898 that the recession, another bank said, I will bail you out of the whole thing. Whitney O'Reilly was, all this for the United States, and it's coming again. They try to break it down by the trust people, coming back great, rising and rising as well.
It might not be only 12 people today, but it's a relatively small number, yes. Okay, well, we got maybe a minute or two if anybody had any other questions or comments. Otherwise, we'll close with the closing hymn, which was 171. I know we went through an awful lot very quickly, and I apologize. But the whole point is that just as with these particular outlines, you have a one-page outline that describes all 3,000 pages of the volumes. Obviously, you're not going to get much out of it. Then you have a one page for each volume. And then we effectively did a one page or a 1 hour for that volume. We could do a one page for each chapter. Each of these is various levels of going into greater and greater detail.
What was your reason for selecting the fourth volume to do this with the other volume?
Because with the flood and everything, I ran out of time and I had it. Now, the reason I selected the fourth volume originally is because we had several class studies, and I recognize the fourth volume is one that many brethren tend to avoid. You know, oh man, that's a really dull and boring book. And so the idea was to try to elicit a little bit of excitement that there is a lot of material, valuable material, in there. Not just, you know, intellectually, but there's practical value to it, knowing about the conditions in the world. So, but nevertheless, that doesn't even help, even in the classes. I know in Wilmington we were going through this. You know, brothers tend to like to talk about politics and finances and that. And the sisters were sitting back absolutely and totally bored and frustrated with the brothers for going on and on about these political statements. Who cares, you know, to them? And so they prevailed, and there was one meeting where on one of the chapters, we took one meeting for the whole chapter because they wanted to get through it. But nevertheless, we tried a few things which made it a little bit easier. And we just felt that it would be a blessing to the brethren and put together those thoughts. I think it's hymn number 171.